I'm Alan Watts, and I've been following politics and geopolitics for a good part of my life. I didn't start off deliberately going out to find out everything that was possibly going on. In fact, I had no idea, to be honest with you, how vast the scale of an agenda, political agenda, is when you're bringing in a global society. Wars have many different purposes. Economics is only simply one big part of it, but cultural change and the building of empire through the defeated nations joining in leagues. Every country was basically signing the same laws, and had been in my whole life, at the same time that affected their societies. Laws were introduced and bills were introduced unbeknownst to the people in those countries that it was being introduced in their neighboring countries or even across the water somewhere at the same time. I realized there was already a governmental control, obviously, that coordinated all of this, and it led me into the United Nations. For every single department of government you have on a federal, local, county, state, provincial level, the United Nations had an equivalent department to deal with everything. It was already set up, in fact, to be global government. H.G. Wells said that the League of Nations, which was the embryo for the United Nations, he said this is the nucleus of the world governments, when eventually all laws will come from there, be passed and signed into law by treaty of all the member countries. Eventually, we won't even have to go through the farce, and that's what it is, of voting in parties or candidates, because in the latter part of the 20th century and now into the 21st century, we're being trained, rather obviously, to simply accept rule by experts, rule by scientists, rule by professionals. And that's what they mean when they call governance. That's the term used. How do you get a domesticated herd to move from a field, a system in which it's been grazing for 20, 50 years, this kind of system, to this field over here, this new field? Because we have reluctance to change. We like familiarity. We like routine, you see. You do it by various techniques, one of which is revolution. Most revolutions are bloodless. You have cultural revolutions, sexual revolutions. Along with that comes the music revolutions, etc. These literally are designed to alter and direct culture, knowing what kind of culture they'll have at the very end of it too. They know exactly what kind of culture they want to come out of it. You also can do it through crisis creation. Crisis after crisis has been hit on the people of the world since 9/11 happened. And we must understand that the techniques that are used abroad are also used at home in warfare. And we heard the term shock and awe. Shock and awe on the hard force level, as they call it, is bombs, all kinds of acoustic equipment to nullify enemies, scare the hell out of them through voice to skull and so on, which was used in Gulf War I, and it's all over the British media. But you can also use shock and awe on your domestic people again. You do it by crisis after crisis until the public are so terrified. See, the average person has a sort of confidence that they build up where they think, I can manage most things that come my way. Whatever little crisis in my life, what happens to other people, I can deal with. When all those around you are getting scared at the same time as you because they're losing their jobs, they've been threatened with pandemics, terrorists everywhere, terrifying people to even get on subways, and so on. And all those around you, as I say, are also in the same boats. You tend to be more easily directed by the powers that be that come out and speak with authority and confidence over you. That's why they give you a guy like Obama, who's trained in oratory. He was trained in oratory, not in truth, but in oratory, the technique of persuasion. Shock and awe, as I say, is a technique of making a person and a whole population punch drunk. And each one of those fears, you see, you understand, the average person can handle one major crisis in their personal life, maybe two at the same time. It's understood in psychology and many, many studies that if you have maybe 3 to 4 crises hitting you personally in your life at the same time, you will literally go into an incredible depression, a reactive depression you can't cope. That's understood. Apply that technique on a whole population. The thing is, there's not one of these crises that we're being told about that you personally can do anything about. What can you do about terrorism if it really exists all over the place? It's out of your hands, you're helpless. What can you do about a coming pandemic? It's out of your hands, you're helpless. What can you do about a nuke getting set off in New York Harbor or wherever? You can't, you're helpless. The message you're getting is that you're utterly helpless to defend, help, or save yourself. That is complete shock and awe tactic. It's been used not only in the US and Canada, but across the world. Same strategy, because we're already global with the global society running us all. Massive psychology and warfare techniques in psychology has been used across the planet to make us succumb to fear and crises, as I say, and none of which we can actually do anything about on an individual level. Therefore, the leaders are presented to us on screen with uniforms or business suits and ties as politicians who speak with confidence, all scripted, of course, and they seem to have everything under control. You're now basically a fearful slave looking up to the powerful master to defend and protect you. That's the simple technique of it. I've been speaking about the Rockefeller Foundation. I was mentioning the fact that in the United States, the Rockefeller Foundation, which also runs, I think it is the Carnegie Foundation today, maybe even the Ford, they're all combined. And the families that are given the intergenerational rights, if you like, or authority to lead the world to amalgamation under global governance. Mr. Rockefeller also is heavily involved in the world depopulation strategies. He funds abortion clinics across the planet. He also funds hundreds of other front foundations that you would think were independent from his, but they're actually front foundations. He funds them all through his money. You can trace them all back again to so-called family planning clinics across the entire globe, especially in the third world countries. It seems that Mr. Rockefeller is intensely worried about overpopulation in the near future from countries which will have no industry, etc., and he sees it as his right to start the decimating process, basically, of depopulation. Last winter, I got an invitation to attend something called the World's Citizenship Council, the annual meeting. That kind of floored me because the head of the World Citizenship Council is Mr. Rockefeller himself. And here I am speaking out about and against them. So this did not come out of the blue. They try and get you on board working for them. What was also more startling was they always give members maybe 15 minutes or 20 minutes to speak, and I was offered that to speak on stage to this world meeting. The world's citizenship idea is part of the old idea of Cecil Rhodes up into Lord Milner to the Royal Institute for International Affairs and the Council on Foreign Relations. Mr. Rockefeller is up on Google in some of his conferences giving out world citizenship awards to very famous people. So they've already bypassed and have bypassed sovereign nations a long time ago. What other benefits you get from being a world citizen, I'm not certain at all. But I was allowed, he said I'd be allowed to speak at this conference. He did not say what to speak about, or didn't say anything what not to speak about. And he also said that this chairman, of course, who wrote to me, he also said that I'd be allowed to participate in the round table groups which come after. The round table society is very, very important because the round table societies were set up as far back as the Milner Society and the Rhodes Foundation. They came out with the first round table societies. What they do is take the topics that are discussed at the main meetings, then they split off at different tables to specialize in certain aspects of the speeches they've heard and find ways how to implement them into reality through media, promotion, various methods of propaganda and so on. I did not attend. I was tempted to go just to see if they would ask me not to speak about certain things, but it was the middle of winter, and the journey to this university would have been pretty hectic anyway, and I was so busy. But you will be approached, and that's not the first time I've been approached to do this kind of thing. You'll find that some people are bought over. I should go back to Lord Bertrand Russell on this topic, because Lord Bertrand Russell said in one of his own books, the same book, in fact, where he talks about those children who manage to escape the indoctrinations, who have intelligence and an ability to communicate to others, must be brought on board the system, employed by the system, bribed into the system, if possible. That generally works with most people. He said, otherwise, we shall have to eliminate them, because they did not want people around who understood an agenda that the general public are unaware of. They didn't want these people with the ability to communicate information, documented information, in a fashion that people understand out in the community where they could spread this word. That ties in with Mao Zedong, who said he was not afraid of armies. His worst fear was someone with a good idea, a great idea, a unique idea, and the ability to communicate it. So that is how they treat, basically, people with information. First comes invitation to join them. Many people do. As I say, Bertrand Russell backed that up by saying if they can't be brought on board, they must be literally eliminated from the public arena. That's how seriously they take this agenda at the top. They don't mess it around. The reason I think they don't simply come out and kill you straightforward is they don't have to do a messy job. There's many ways of killing you, especially in this day and age. But I think, to be honest, they're so arrogant right now at this moment. They're not too worried about the mass of the general population who are indoctrinated and updated with their indoctrination daily from television, as one example. About 100 years ago, this big organization with many branches, they wanted to rule the world, basically using Britain as a nucleus of a system, an embryo, which also was going to be joined with the US under the Anglo-American establishment, wrote about the kind of culture and the changes of culture over a 100-year period that they would actually design. We're all tribal to an extent. That's why we even bother to vote for a tribal leader. This is well understood. That's why we're supplied with these leaders. And because the average man was to become more disengaged from his own destiny as the expert class arose, it was decided that the males would get their outlet, basically, gradually becoming helpless as males, through sports. Therefore, they'd have a tribal team they could identify with. They could cheer them on as they were winning. In their own personal lives, they were getting nowhere. They were getting disenfranchised, in a sense, as experts took over decision-making for them in all kinds of fields. So this was psychology at use, planned before they even implemented the sports. When radio came along, of course, they used that to the maximum. Sports for the men, radio soaps, basically, for the women. And then in came television, as I say, with its alpha state, its hypnotic state. It took off. It really, really took off. And men became glued to the sports shows. The big think tanks, and we've had think tanks to do with always planning the future and how they would create societies and even different cultures within 100 years, say, from this type of society to that society to the next society, how they'd implement it, again, always through the youth culture, which is easy to do if you have universal education. You can always mandate the same system, same culture to be taught to the youth. However, as I say, since the 1960s, once television really, really took off, sports used to only come out on Saturdays. And over a 10-year period, it gradually came on every night of the week. Until today, we have even sports channels, sports, sports, sports. And now you see guys who are sitting home, who are basically powerless at work. They have bosses. They're powerless on the roads. There's police and traffic wardens and cops watching them. They have no means to feel strong. And so they tend to watch sports as a substitute. They project themselves into a game which they never participate in. But as long as their team wins, they feel something's happening in their life that's positive and it's successful. It's a very good substitute for many, many things. as far as the elite are concerned. Now, the big think tanks that involved many professional people knew that they'd have to give something that's for the males, and for the women they'd also give a substitute too. The intention being ultimately to alter society, drastically alter it so much that even the purpose, for instance, of marriage would lose any appeal. For the females, they gave them high fashion, accessible prices for high fashion clothes. They brought in, people don't realize, they brought in the miniskirt back in the 1920s during Prohibition. They brought in cocaine at the same time as along with the booze to get young people in. The idea being that if you're doing something illegal, it's very naughty. Youngsters love to break the rules, get together, we're all being naughty together. And sex and booze, coupled with coke being smuggled in at that time, had its desired effects, but not quite the way it was designed to have by those that planned that culture, the Bernays types. And Bernays was heavily involved in this. So they came out, as I say, with not sex and rock and roll, but sex in a form of jazz. The Charleston dance came in, the miniskirt came in, sex became rather rampant for the first time. All the old traditional taboos were broken with one generation. But there was fallout to this change, this massive change in culture. The fallout being that they did not have the antibiotics to treat all the sexually transmitted disease that came along. Secondly, they didn't have the legal abortion clinics to take care of the unwanted children that also were produced by hyper-promiscuity. They opened up big orphanages to try and take care of this, the boys' towns, they had ones for girls too. But there was so much backlash, especially in the United States, from the old Christian communities, that they had to tone it all down. It kind of flopped, as I say. Sexually transmitted disease became rampant, so did unwanted pregnancies and abortions. And so they went back to the drawing board, because remember, before this all happened, the big players, the new high priesthood, we'll call them, of the Time Lords, those who create the future, work in think tanks for the big establishment, had a definite mandate. The only problem was how do you achieve that mandate over a time period. So they went back to the drawing board, and they've always known, for instance, that in wartime, more children are produced because people, young people who might go off to die tomorrow tend to be far more promiscuous. They brought this back after World War II, big time, and worked on it steadily. All our tax money went into one particular area of research, not just for the atomic weaponry and so on. It went into finding ways of finding a contraceptive that was effective. When they found it and launched it on the scene, at the same time as it launched what they called pop music, along with drugs, LSD and so on, they brought out the contraceptive. So then permission was given, in a sense, and promoted from the top down, even from the BBC, which is, remember, the BBC is owned by the British government. It's an arm of the British government. It talks on behalf of the dominant minority who rule Britain. So they began to promote all this stuff. All the DJs they'd bring on television would interview the top pop stars of the day. They were all stoned out of their minds. Some of them were falling out of chairs. And the interviewers would say, "Tee-hee, aren't we naughty children?" All aimed at a young generation to emulate. This is what we do. Monkey see, monkey do. Once again, remember, the prime intent was to break the old culture of boy meets girl, going together for a while, getting engaged, getting married, having children. The family unit, they'd said, when they had the League of Nations, which was the precursor of the United Nations, said they'd have to destroy the family unit. Pretty well all of H.G. Wells' non-fiction books promotes all of this agenda. And in fact, he coined the term in the late 1800s. This is how far back this agenda of promiscuity had to go. He coined the term free love. And in one of his books written before 1890, he says, we must promote free love in order to destroy and end the obsolete family unit. Once that's done, he said, the family is no longer in the way when government comes for an individual. Each individual will be solely responsible to the government itself, and no family will stand up around them like a primitive tribe and defend them. At the same time, the foundations within the United States and Britain and elsewhere were funding what appeared to be far-left groups, communist groups. So much so, as I say, the Rees Commission went in to look into this from the 50s to find out why top capitalists who owned international corporations and banks, international banks, were putting up foundations to fund far-left groups. Well, we know now it was to literally destroy the old culture in order to bring in the new culture, the new society. So therefore you have the proliferation of sexual activity. The fallout still came from unwanted pregnancies, far reduced than it had been before because of contraception. But then came the lead of the feminist charge, again funded by the Rockefeller Foundation in the States, to spearhead and demonstrate and demand the rights for abortion. If they could get the public to devalue human life, and that's in the writings of Julian Huxley. He says if we can get society to devalue human life, he says, and take humanity off its pedestal as a supreme being on the planet, then, he said, we can bring in our controlled society with a workable population. Everything works within culture towards an agenda. And as Plato said so long ago, over 2,300 years ago, he said, culture and cultural changes must be authorized from the top. If it's grassroots, truly grassroots, then it's outside of the elite's control, and ripple effects could occur, and it could spread anywhere. They couldn't control it, contain it anymore. Therefore, the major changes in culture, which Plato said came through drama and the emulation of actors, actresses, including fashions that they wore, and the music they heard, had to be strictly regulated and authorized from the top. The whole science of this, which was always a science and understood by those in those businesses, was used to the maximum to literally drastically alter culture so radically in the 60s and 70s that they could never return to a past way of living. We tie that in with another big player, Lord Bertrand Russell, who had experimental schools under royal charter, where he could do things that anyone else would be locked up for doing. He said in his own schools, and they were mixed schools, he said that if he could encourage prepubertal sexuality amongst the children, encourage multiple partners from before puberty, he says the chances, because of study and observation, the chances of them ever bonding with one person for the rest of their life was pretty well obsolete, null and void, wouldn't happen. Therefore, that technique all came into play during the 60s. It was called free love. Drugs helped it along the way. And that was the beginning of what we saw as short-term relationships. Divorces became more and more common. Interestingly enough, divorces really took off not because society demanded it or it came from a need or demand from the people. Divorces took off because the Hollywood stars, and remember too, the drama industry, the entertainment industry have always said this, the people follow the stars. And they're the guiding stars in the so-called occult, you see. We tend to worship wealth and people and famous people. We want to be like them. We want to identify with them. The whole idea of divorces came out from Hollywood, the top stars leading the charge for this. Women started to talk about it, who was getting divorced, what actress from what guy and so on. And gradually it put the idea across to them that, well, if they're getting divorced, then maybe so should I. At the same time, the Bourdais techniques were used through all kinds of magazines. At that time, 97% of all magazine publications were aimed at women. Because advertisers have said, and it's still taught in marketing schools today, women are far more easy to get to go along with something new than males are. So within all these magazines and write-ups about their famous actresses, their heroines and so on, the rich ones, the average women were reading these stories and identifying with them. They were being told that you can do anything, you can have it all. You could have a career, you can have a family, you had a home. They gave them utter lies, and they coined the term superwoman. So across the whole of Europe and the States and Canada, at the same time, always coordinated at the same time, the media entertainment industry were promoting stories of superwomen. And they'd find someone, real or imaginary, we'll never know, who supposedly was a CEO of a company, who had all these children at home, had a great husband, could manage everything and could cook great cuisine, blah, blah. And that, of course, is a fantasy. This put pressure again on most women to try and live up to the fantasy, as all advertising does. And most of the stuff we're getting is advertising, or at the very least, is basic psychological manipulation. Bernays techniques, again, remembering too that he called it the creation of a consumer society. Well-behaved people, as long as there's money going around, they would go into the material world and they would forgo having children. That's the same thing as Charles Galton Darwin talks about. If we can encourage the woman and the male to go after the material benefits of the world, there's a slimmer chance they'll actually have children who tend to be economically burdensome. People were addicted to television in a very short space of time. Most people still today think that all entertainment to do with movies, drama, is therefore nothing more than their entertainment. It never, ever was that case. The greatest social messages are promoted through movies and drama, high drama, through the fixation of emotive sequences, emotional sequences, not logical, factual sequences, but pushing points across in an emotional way which register and fix in the mind. So emotional content is very, very important, rather than going through an actual discussion or an argument using logic and facts. There's no debate. And when you're being downloaded through fiction, your guard is down, the sensor part of your brain is not in action as you would in a debate or a lecture. You're actually in an alpha state, being completely downloaded with new ideas. Very similar to a computer. And so therefore, a culture industry, which is called by its own the culture industry. The Soviet Union had a department called the culture industry. Their actors and directors were called the cultural leaders. All you have to do is keep giving them new updates every so often, and you can change an entire country or a nation or a block of nations who are all getting the same upgrades at the same time along certain paths. Today we call it political correctness. Most people want to belong to their peer group. They want to be the same as everyone else when it comes to opinions. In fact, they judge their own personal sanity by bouncing ideas off their neighbours and friends who will answer back and agree on these same topics in kind. It doesn't matter if the topics or what you're given are facts or utter nonsense. As long as everyone agrees at the same time, you'll say, well, I'm sane, and your friends will all agree because they've had the same information given to them. We don't only get the same information given to us. We're led through sequences, even documentaries, to leave you with a predetermined fixed conclusion on any given topic. Most folk are, once again, unaware of this. They think, I've just been given all the facts on this topic, and this is the obvious conclusion, which is always given to you by the final experts on the particular program. There's no thinking involved. We tie this in with the Brzezinski. Brzezinski said in Two Ages, now this guy was way up with the NSA. He's a master geopolitician. He admits he works in 20, 50-year periods to do with geopolitics in other countries. But he said himself, the public will shortly be unable to think or reason for themselves. He says it was meaning by the form that information that was given to them, the type, the formulas that were in use then in the 1970s. And eventually, he said, they will expect the media to do all their thinking and reasoning for them. Well, that's happened today. That's why people today can't think outside of the programming from television. Give an instance, in fact, of why TV was so important, to show you that it was so important to have it in the homes of ordinary people. Now, most countries in Europe, for instance, up into the 1950s and 60s, and I'll give an example, is Britain. The working class people did not have credit cards. You could not get a credit card. You couldn't get a bank loan without collateral to put something up against it. So therefore, you were at a pretty well a fixed income. There was no extra cash outside of rent, food and so on, clothes for the children, essentials. There was no extras for luxuries. There was no credit given to them. Yet the British government, just like the Chinese government did 2 years ago, made it a mandate that every household in Britain must get a television set. And what they did, they made one exception out of all the things that the people could need, really needed. They made one exception. They allowed credit companies to come into being. They could go round the houses every week and collect half a crown or 5 shillings or whatever it was and pay off a used television set. The British government made a deal with the United States of America to buy in used televisions, which were then reconditioned, to be sold to the working class all across Britain. As I say, they wanted a TV in every home. Now, since when is government interested in how happy you are at home? You know, there's another reason for this. And sure enough, the working classes all got these DER. DER was the company that brought them all into to Britain. And the guys came around every weekend collecting their half crown, 5 shillings. And suddenly, this, and I can remember where I was. It was one of the last areas, really, to get television, a real working class area. I can remember this high being taken by my parents to the local park on a weekend and passing dozens and dozens and dozens of other couples on the way with their toddlers as well. When he got to the park, which was a valley, there were over maybe 1,000, 1,500 couples along the grass in the valley. And that's where everything was discussed. Local politics, national politics, labor unions to do with their mining and so on. And everyone mingled with everyone else, old school friends and so on. That system had been going on for hundreds of years. People communicated thoughts, real feelings, real things that really mattered to them and their communities, to each other, conversation. When the TV came in, and I was still about this high, within about a month, I could go down that park every weekend and no one was there. It literally overnight killed off the socialization and interaction between people and tradition, again, where they exchanged viewpoints, gave each other news, helped each other out, who was sick, who was this, who was that. Everyone helped each other out. And from then on, you could pass rows and rows and rows of these old, and they were called row houses, all joined together. And all you saw at night was the flickering of that bluish light in the windows. And that was the end. That was the end of real communities. It happened within a matter of about a month. The flicker rate on the television is very, very important. It was timed to be so many cycles per second, and it actually just meets with the brain patterns for an alpha state. When our brain sees it through our eyes, we start to adopt that flicker rate in our mind, and we go into a deep alpha state. Watch children and watch their mouths. They drop open. They won't hear their parents talking. They're hypnotized, in fact. Why would they give that particular flicker rate when they could have chosen of a whole variety of flicker rates? It wasn't an essential thing to have. So it was done for a purpose. It was meant to be hypnotic. It was meant to be used as a tool of propaganda and indoctrination, even through the guise of entertainment and so on. It also was to create a new society because they were the avant-garde, as I say, leading the sexual revolution through drama, through little documentaries, fiction, non-fiction, all combined. Once again, back to Plato, the audience see what they see. You understand that it's even worked out towards different age groups. There's something on for everybody, everybody's age group. Each age group is actually being updated as well, even the elderly ones, into new ways of thinking or seeing things. But the target mainly was for youngsters. If we take one of the world's experts on propaganda, who is Jacques Ellul, who wrote extensively on how the mind works and how all entertainment, he said, that has to do with government programs such as police, detective stories, detective series, which contain little human dramas as the hook that you identify with to make you watch the whole story. Child gets kidnapped, detective goes on a hunt, he goes through hell and what, fire, to get that child back. You identify with the hero if you're a male, you'll identify with the heroine if you're female. And that's the hook to get you to watch them. But what he said was, all dramas to do with police, or even the military in movies, are pure propaganda. Pure propaganda. The human story is just the bait to make you watch through it, to get you to identify with it. Because once again, there's always a message left somewhere in the movie. It might even be a message that's against your own morality. It could be where the cop, for instance, does sleep with this beautiful woman while his wife is at home, and it's all part of the story, and even tell you why he did this. He was feeling down that day, blah, blah, blah. And so you've just again altered your viewpoints on how you yourself might behave in that situation. And it's sometimes that kind of thing can be justified. That's how you're downloaded through entertainment. It's there to alter and direct and always upgrade into another step of the direction that the entire culture for someone else's purpose. Let's talk about the effects of the alpha state first of all. Recent articles I've even read on the air from various science studies show you that even when you switch off television, you remain in that alpha state for maybe 45 minutes to an hour, sometimes longer, depending on how long you've been watching it. With high definition, why would a president of a country mandate that all TVs had to go high definition? Is it because he really cares so much about your happiness? And he wants better quality for you? Or is there another reason for it? Well, I'm sure the effects of the old flicker rates and what it did will also be incorporated in high definition, but with even more added benefits for bringing you into a complete hypnotic state. How do you wake someone up who's addicted to television? You can't. Very, very simple. You can't get your daily brainwashing. We're literally, it's bypassing any consciousness in the person. You can't take that every day and still try to wake up and learn at the same time. I've known people who've gone through complete withdrawal from television and gone into depressions because their entire routine is broken. They also have time on their hands, which is a big aspect of control, remember, too. If you can take time away from a person who can think for themselves, who might say, oh, I'll go and read a book, I'll go and study something, or if you can take that time away from them and have them mesmerized in front of a television set, then you'll keep them dumb, stupid, compliant, and going along with the system. I always advise to people, if you know someone who's watching TV, it's quite simple to find out where they are mentally, psychologically, in the understanding of things. You can ask them a few simple questions. If they give you standard television answers, forget it. Simple as that, forget it. If you see some spark of their own opinion coming in, there's maybe a chance you can do something with them. But you cannot get off. You see, television it can be classified as a drug. Any addiction is still an addiction. Television is an addiction. People watch 4 or 5 hours per day. Top psychologists and even the United Nations have talked about the use of television for creating the new culture for children. How many people know that all government agencies or departments, all governments in the world, basically, have departments of culture which hire cartoonists and pay their expenses to do cartoons, always incorporating the latest political correct story to do with environment, waste, bad adults, and how they've destroyed the planet through their consuming, etc. Have many people realize, as you plonk your children down in front of it to babysit them, that they're actually being brainwashed scientifically? And these cartoons were designed by experts to get their message across to those children, implanted in their young minds, fixed in their young minds forever, for the rest of their lives, ongoing daily, and even right down to the novels that you read to the children that are designed for children too, which will incorporate all of this, all paid by government grants to authors and writers. You literally have to take it into your own hands. It's one of the most dangerous tools that can be used. It's also dangerous in this extent that why do you think government licenses TV stations? If you were an independent producer, TV station who came out with this kind of information, you would not get a license. You'd have to be authorized and politically correct with a whole bunch of things to do and not to do written out before you'd be given a license. And you'd be checked on every so often to make sure you were following those topics that you're allowed to. If you want to advise people on television, and you can do this with yourself, how to train yourself, how to watch television. If you never get involved, you understand a storyline, you watch a movie, but don't get involved in, as I say, there's always a thread or a hook for you to follow, a plot, whatever, the chase. The guy always ends up with the beautiful woman at the end after going through hell to rescue a child or whatever it happens to be, or save the world. If you can stop yourself from getting lost in the emotional part of it and study the movie as you're watching it, you'll learn the techniques that have been implanted in the movie itself. That's a great way to learn. If you can do it with yourself, you can also show other people how to do this, to actually study everything as it's been presented to you. And eventually what you'll find is that when you're watching even documentaries, you'll see how the documentaries themselves are shaped to give you the opinions, often very strong opinions, without giving you specific facts or giving you distorted facts, etc. Learn how to critically analyze and think as you're watching. And if you can show others this technique, a good example is sit down with someone who regularly watches a good movie, one that you've previously watched, and then point out all the politically correct little inserted words, slogans, phrases that have been put in there, and show them. Show them how it's been done. That way it can actually be fun to study television and write down all the different things that they've missed, but it's all implanted subconsciously in their mind. Because those implants, those subconscious implants, will become their opinions, and they will never know how they arrived at them. They won't remember it's from this particular documentary, this particular movie, or whatever. So that can also be fun. That's a positive side of it. You can train anyone to do this. With the internet, the first person to mention it that I know of, at least to the public, was again this master, Brzezinski, in his book Between Two Ages. In the early 70s, he said, shortly a system will be given to the public of mass communication, which will cause a revolution, the revolutionary thing to change society. But he also mentioned and hinted at the fact that there would be regulation behind it. He mentioned too that those who brought it in would never lose control, the main control over the internet, because after all, knowledge is power. Knowledge has always been power. That's why all down through the ages, the real machinations of government are never told to the public. Real power comes from understanding and having all the facts on any particular topic. So therefore, the internet was to be given to the general public with other intentions. Initially, it was to get them all into it. Now, what did the elite want to achieve? What was their point of view? They wanted people to become so used to the internet they couldn't do without it. Now we see businesses really can't do without it. They can't imagine going back to pencil and paper and taking inventory and all this kind of stuff. For the youngsters, who must be the generation they target, they made sure that's the only thing I knew about the internet from the media. I was completely ignorant about it and computers. The only thing I knew was there was lots of pornography on it. Every paper kept telling you about it, which again, it's the same old technique they used in the 60s and 70s aren't we naughty, wink, wink, for the rock stars on television. Knowing all the youngsters would get into it when their hormones are high, that's all they're thinking about. But once folk were addicted to it, they also planned to gradually alter it, keeping the people addicted to it as they changed it into another system where mainstream media, the authorized media, the culture creation industry media, would eventually have prime or the main dibs, the first grabs at the main bandwidth that eventually they're claiming will have to be reduced. So in the meantime, there's never been a window of opportunity for the general public to use a medium to communicate to each other alternate news, verified facts to each other as we have at the moment. That eventually, supposedly, is going to be policed. They've had international meetings, the first one held in Canada, under the guise of the United Nations, or the auspices of the United Nations, to do with regulating and censorship of the internet. They have these meetings every year as they add more laws to it. We know the cloud system is to come in eventually. It's been all over the media in Britain, where you won't be able to store anything on a hard drive. You won't even need a hard drive eventually. Remote servers will have all your information for you. It will then be used as a form of punishment if you were politically incorrect in some form or another. Then you'll be cut off from accessing that server with all your data until you toe the line and behave yourself. Social control can be used through money, monetary penalizations, or through other penalizations like withdrawing you access from it. It definitely will be used for social control again, unless it's a backlash from the general public. And they do expect backlashes from people who have become used to looking into whatever site they wish to look at, or communicating whatever kind of information they want to each other. Now, along with the introduction of the internet, we've got to remember too, the government agencies also set up and promoted chat rooms and all the rest of it. And there are agents within this strange nether region called the internet whose job it is to infiltrate people who are coming together as groups, communicating on specific topics to do with political changes and disrupting those groups. So already it's a battlefield, and they called it the cyber wars long before they even gave this internet to the people. It'd been an informational war, they said, in all the papers. Therefore, government intelligence agencies would have to expand their roles with mandates to also be in this invisible world where they would manipulate various groups from within as well. There's also a lot of nonsense, of course, on the internet too, which can take you down conspiracy paths. I hate the term conspiracy because the government wants us to use it like we're some sort of hobbyists and some sort of kooks. I don't use the term. But that's become the most popular type of site now, is conspiracy site. And there's many out there, there's professional agents out there as well, who've been funded by governments and even launched by governments, to be well known, especially in Europe, to lead the conspiracy sites. Then they bring in the UFOs, the aliens, until you have achieved your goal. Counterintelligence. Let's talk about counterintelligence and how it works. What is intelligence? Intelligence gathering is sending agents out to simply listen. They listen in marketplaces, bars, cafes, as to what the people are discussing. Lawrence of Arabia, in his own book, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, was trained as an agent. He was trained in Arabic languages. He was given lots of money, he and 11 other people, trained from Cambridge, and sent over to the Arabic countries to start up Arabic newspapers. Once they started putting stories in the newspapers, they went around the marketplaces, they hired lots of guys to listen to gossip, to see if the intelligence they were putting out in the papers was being discussed by the recipients, the readers. That's basic intelligence gathering. What is counterintelligence? Counterintelligence, from a government's perspective, is taking information and data that could be bad for the ruling regime. and finding ways to counter that knowledge, counter it. What you do, standard-wise, if you can't defame the person who's bringing out a truth or kill them, is to bring out your own heroes. Launch them well, finance them well into the same area, saying the same stuff that others are talking about. It's called intelligence, giving out facts. And once they have the following, then they start bringing in aliens and UFOs, and they bring in the New Age, the whole New Age religion into it. Spirituality is the big term they're using today. Until a newcomer, a skeptic, will hear this stuff from the paid agent, who's very good, who says the same, gives the same data as the person who doesn't go into the UFOs and so on. But the guy who doesn't go into the UFOs, aliens, reptilians and all the rest of it, suddenly is thrown out with the other guy. You're classified with them by association. Your topics are associated. Even though you stay clear of the fantasy stuff, the disinformation, you'll be lumped along with them. And then you've countered the intelligence. When you mention the facts, people laugh at you, say, oh, you probably believe that the aliens are running the world now. And that's it. That's counterintelligence. And that is also all over the internet. And it's paid for by, again, government psyops operations. Some groups that I've found are doing really good work, where people decide to get together physically, and they will choose a book to read to do with the factual data that's available to the public that can be proven.
Oh, Henry Kissinger.
And they'll go through it. They'll analyze the book. They'll analyze the phrases. They'll analyze the contents. They start to participate in what they're reading, because others will remember this particular era, this time when this event happened, can add to the thing and so on. That's participation. That's communication. And other information, as I say, from those involved who live through things can be added to the whole thing, giving you a much more complete picture. So it's a good idea to take to start this kind of thing off in your local area, even if it's only two of you that started off. Don't sit and laugh. It's kind of comical at first when you say, well, we're going to discuss this book. You've never done anything less in your lifetime. Sit down and get yourself a coffee or a beer or whatever you need, and take turns at reading. And ask the other guy, do you have anything to add to what I've just read? Do you have any insights into it? What do you think of this? It gets you stimulated into participating and really thinking, because everybody who's alive today has been trained literally not to have to think. As Brzezinski said, shortly the public will be unable to reason or think for themselves. They'll expect the media to do their reasoning for them. So let's counter that. Let's get back to thinking for ourselves, using the data, the material, get involved, start using our minds again. And you'll be surprised, it's like a muscle you haven't used for a long time, how quickly you start to use it, how sharp you become so quickly. And if you can get larger groups and larger groups together doing the same thing, and then you can branch them together, communicate together, then they suggest other books that you haven't heard of. Maybe you need a particular book for evidence. I have stacks of them at home. Everyone has access somewhere to some material that got stuck away. And when you start putting all of this material together, mainly through, as I say, discussion and reading groups, you can add to the knowledge. The more knowledge and facts, actual factual data you can put together, the bigger your arsenal is. And the easier it becomes to show people and convince them, look, this is authenticated stuff. Here's the factual data. Here's the physical book. Read from that book and then have your discussions. What do you think about this? What do you think they meant by this? What do you think has happened? Have they fulfilled this part of an agenda? And most people will say, yeah, they have. Well, here's how they did it. The evidence is all there, but knowledge, remember, is scattered. That's also why, since the 70s and so on, televisions were put up in places where people used to communicate to each other, bars and restaurants, the pubs of Europe. Everyone talked and discussed everything. The televisions were all put in for a reason. And now everyone's mesmerized and you can hear sports or loud music. You can't communicate anymore. That was government promoters, because the government licensed the big chains of taverns and pubs all throughout Europe. And so what you've got really It's a deliberate attempt. Nothing happens for no reason. Why? The customers weren't demanded. They were bored in bars as they discussed topics. People would just move around the pub talking and listening to the conversations, and they'd join in the one that he liked. Why was it so important to destroy communication? It's because it's a main propaganda tool that stops communication between people, even in a room. If you notice, too, they don't even discuss the topics, once the news is read to them, to each other. They've both been downloaded with the opinions. You don't have to ask what their opinion is. It's going to be the same one as you've been downloaded with, left by the expert. So we've got to get back to communications and communicating with each other and finding the evidence. Knowledge is scattered. Knowledge is power, so it's scattered all over the place and thousands of books. But when you can start these reading classes up and get other reading classes communicating with you, even through the internet, you can start putting the data, the factual data together, and so that you can present it to the public and bring in more and more members. Only knowledge and the will to use this knowledge is going to thwart the plans that have openly been made for us and declared from the elites at the top. The whole problem of being involved in a community can be a double-edged sword. We know, for instance, that communitarianism, it's a term used first by Bush Sr., talking about the collectivist society coming in. The United Nations has us all split up into communities. It's promoted through local TV. Even Sudbury here has your community. This is your local community. Be involved in your community. They're talking about a politically correct community. That's the problem. Government really penetrated and altered and distorted and changed society through communities. Not just with television, which has certainly destroyed the community spirit. The intent of governments, and this is how abusers work too. Abusers work with the same technique because they want power over a victim. The abuser will come in and take care initially of problems of the abused. Often the problems are the very outcome of what the abusers have been doing to the victims in the first place. Governments came in with welfare, for instance, a long time ago, in all countries about the same time. At one time, families helped each other out. You didn't need welfare. If someone lost their job, everyone chipped in. You didn't condemn the family member for being unemployed or ill or whatever, or losing their job. Families helped each other. Now, the family, remember, is still really the smallest nucleus of a tribe. And then government came in with unemployment insurance, which they took off you, but nothing was for free. And gradually over time, when people became unemployed or even sick for a while and couldn't work, I heard people even say to their own relatives, well, go to welfare, that's what they're for. There are social agencies to deal with this. Until today, we're in a sad state where even close relatives won't help each other out. They expect the government, the abuser, the government is the abuser. They expect the government to take care of all financial problems for the unfortunate victims. And they stop helping each other out. We've got to start reclaiming the rights to, and you can do it personally with people you know, to help other people out and start countering the government's mandate. Because the government's mandate is for control over the victims, not to help the victims. Those who fall under that particular level into the welfare state have their lives run by government agencies and social workers. That's what Huxley says. He says that they won't need their survival capabilities. Russell said the same thing, because the government is taking care and making all the decisions for them. In order to help you, it's really to take you over and have you obeying them and their system. That's what you're up against, a planned war strategy, making them dependent upon government services, not their family units, not their brothers and sisters, their fathers or mothers, but on the state itself. We've got to counter that and become involved again in the lives of those around us and have our own true communities. It doesn't matter if there's only five of you in a community, even if you live in a town or a city. That's your own little community. We all have something in common. What it really is gaining knowledge for your own and others' self-preservation and survival into the future. I'm Alan Watts, and I'm an author and researcher into geopolitics, really, and history. I follow where the world has been, the techniques were used to bring them to those stages and apply them to where we are today and where how the future is planned. I've researched so many books. I've got a library of my own. I like paperback books, or at least hardback books, because they're permanent records of the past. And if you can't understand the past, you won't understand the present or the future. I've also been in the music business, heavily involved for years. And I saw how culture creation worked from the top, and how generations were swayed into new fashions, new ideas. I've been following the histories of what's now called the New World Order for many, many years. And I try to go into the books written by the big players, the technocrats themselves, those famous people like the Kissingers, the Brzezinskis and so on, the Huxleys, the Lord Bertrand Russells, who all worked for the same organizations. And I came to the conclusion, really, there was only one big organization with many subcategories. These boys tend to publish the world that they saw coming into view, and they wrote it in their own hand, basically. They told us where they were taking the world. And when you start studying these things about the age of 14, 15, or even younger, and reading their books, and you live long enough, you will see that the world has turned out exactly as they planned. This can't be coincidence. And who can really write up a wish list and make it happen globally, unless there is an organization, very, very powerful, probably the only organization really on the planet, an organization that can fund all sides, all oppositions, and using the synthesis of conflicting parties, they can literally make the world come into view as they planned. They plan in centuries, and the astonishing thing is when you go into the United Nations, which was loosely based on the Soviet system, they plan certain parts of their agenda in 50-year plans, some in 100-year plans, and some even in 150-year plans for different aspects of it. The Russells, the Huxleys and so on, Brzezinskis, also use the same terminology with their long-term plans. And you've got to understand, too, that nothing in culture comes out from the grassroots. Even Plato talked about that thousands of years ago. He said that if it was a grassroots movement really coming from the people, then those in charge, the dominant minority, would lose control. Therefore, every change in culture, right down to fashion and music, and this was written 2,300 years ago, had to be authorized from the top and promoted from the top if it fitted with the continuance of control over the public. And these are sciences which were taught down through the ages, are still taught today to the big players, and they've used it to the full in the 20th century, now into the 21st century with the use of television, mass communications, radio, etc. Everything has been given to us for the appropriate time and stage in the actual planning. And for those who are coming into this kind of study, it's best to go into the books, as I say, written by the big players themselves. They love to boast. Kissinger's got lots of books out there, so has Brzezinski. These are probably two of the master players in geopolitics. Try to stay away from all the conspiracy books. They're also put out there on purpose, very fascinating books, but they lead you in circles forever without giving you the overall picture. Two, the fact that every generation has a purpose up until this present time. And in a post-industrial era, these big boys have decided, and their masters too, that we are simply superfluous and they no longer need us. Hence, we have big foundations coming forward and organizations like the Optimum Population Trust who have decided to come out openly and demand that governments start radically reducing the populations. We are now the useless eaters, as Lord Bertrand Russell called us. Our ideas, our opinions on everything, our worldview, even to do with population and the fake view that we're overpopulated, is all projected to us by the mainstream media working in concert for their masters. And we begin to parrot what we hear through repetition. And that's so important, is repetition with slogans and catchphrases. And once you hear it happening in your own local group, your milieu, then you know it's working. And the camera can make anything appear to be true. You'll see that in India, for instance, they always use the same streets of Bombay to make you think that you're massively overcrowded, and that's the impression people think of the entire Indian continent. The Indian continent is huge, with thousands and thousands of miles of forest where no one lives. It's the same in Africa too. China, being the model state for the world, for instance, put into effect the United Nations policy to the extreme with its population reduction and the movements of people off of the rural areas into cities. They said that years ago. Right now, they're in the process of moving 200 million more people off into the major cities, and that's in the major newspapers. The cities appear to be crowded because everyone's being moved into them. In the Western world, since the 1950s, again under the term of urban sprawl and stopping urban sprawl, the Western countries also signed agreements to do no more building in the outskirts and of the major cities. All existing buildings have to be used or else knocked down, replaced with even higher ones. But regardless, with the immigration and the free flow of people now from third world countries, the Western countries appear to be overcrowded. And yet the UN's own statistics show, and sort of the national census show, that the Europeans, for instance, Canadians and Americans, who have been here for a couple of hundred years, are actually in decline. So the overpopulation problem is simply an image projected by the media as more and more people are crammed into the same cities and they bring more immigrants in to fill them. But I also realized the system of schooling when I was going to school was bogus. The histories were bogus. And I was very, very lucky to have access to very old libraries, town libraries. Some of them had reference books going back into the 1700s, written at the time. When you compared the histories I was being taught in school to the histories that were written at the time, they were completely different. You had a deeper understanding of how geopolitics had been used in the past to even populate the country of Canada. London couldn't get immigrants to go off into the new colonies. What they did for Australia was to create so many laws that you couldn't help but break them, and poverty, and therefore stealing a loaf of bread to feed you or your family would get you deported to Australia with your family. That's how they populated Australia, crime. They created the laws for crime. With Scotland, they had a rebellion, which could have been rigged, and I often think it was, and the whole of Scotland was punished, and they deported millions of the Scots off to the Americas to populate the Americas. This is geopolitics in action. That's how it works. And whole peoples are often moved from their land because the elite masters want them elsewhere to be productive for them, themselves, the masters. When you look at the strategy for the US and Canada, again, long-term strategy, long-term planning, you'll find that the big corporations of their day, the Hudson's Bay companies, the Fraser companies, were given charters to own the land before Canada was Canada or US was the US. They were simply called the Americas. These were private international corporations that had the power of life and death over everyone who lived within their areas. The Queen or the King had a consulate in every country, a Lieutenant General or Governor General, they call them. We still have one in Canada today, who represents the Queen. They have all the powers over life and death of subjects under that governor. How they stopped rebellion in the past was to give us an idea of what they called democracy. They knew from the Chartist movement in Britain, for instance, and elsewhere, other countries, people were demanding rights for the first time. And so once again, they gave us champions to speak on our behalf, which calmed the people down, thinking for the first time in history, the people were involved in their own destiny creation, and nothing was further from the truth. Because the planners knew that once you bring people into a country or a continent, create real wealth for them and get businesses going, clear the land, drain the swamps, and so on. They can take it all away from you through laws 200 years down the road. And that's what's happening now. Long-term geopolitics once more. And if you think I'm kidding about this, go into the history books written at the time. They're still there in some of the libraries. And you can also go into the art of geopolitics. There's even videos on YouTube on Brzezinski boasting about how he set up the Taliban in Afghanistan. You'll see him encourage them to fight the Soviets at that time in the 1970s. And he actually says, yours is a holy war. This man, who obviously believes in nothing but himself and his own peer group, is encouraging another people to go and fight a holy war, a jihad. And he uses these terms against the Soviets, knowing full well, once it was set up and it was backed by the CIA, that 10, 15 years down the road, they'd be a problem. And then they'd have to go to war with the very group they'd created to fight the Soviets. That's what's happening today. Long-term strategies. Well, that's how history has always been run. If you can go into the books where you find the British Home Office is mentioned, study the history of the diplomatic corps. Because the diplomats were spies. They would go into territories, set up embassies, collect intelligence data for future invasions. Their job was also to try and grab the rights of minerals, gold, silver, etc. across the planet, all natural resources, and find ways, long-term strategy, to either bribe it off the present rulers of those countries or else create an ultimate war with them and simply steal it under the guise of occupation. We're living through a stage today, as I say, where this is all coming to a culmination. This is the post-industrial era. We're post-technical, almost, in the West. It's all done in other countries, all the technical stuff. And Brzezinski himself talks about the technocratic era, where the future will be for an elite with a highly trained bureaucracy underneath them and scientific elite who will not need the human labor that they've needed in the past. Human labor that is excessive and is unemployed and is hungry is now a threat to that established elite. So now they're doing something which they can only do to the human species. They don't need to do this with animals. With animals, just go out and hunt them and kill them. We are the only species that has to be convinced to allow ourselves, for the good of all, to be sterilized and bring down the population through abortion on one end and euthanasia on the other, under the guise to save the planet. And unfortunately, with the massive propaganda campaigns that are all over media and every country at the same time, with all the big foundations backing them with unlimited financing. Remember, the foundations are owned by the international bankers themselves. Then they can pull all of this off, and unfortunately it really is working. In kindergarten now, you walk into a kindergarten anywhere in Europe or Americas, and you'll see the rainbow inside every single one of them. You'll see all the terms about the world. Here's the globe, we're all global. And you'll see the greeting messages everywhere, and how sacrifice will have to be made to save the world and the planet and future generations of society. Sacrifice. You tie that together with the institutions that were comprised of the Fabian Society. It was a member of the Royal Institute for International Affairs. That's one society. The Council on Foreign Relations is also the same thing as the Royal Institute for International Affairs. They are what Thatcher and Professor Carl Quigley called the parallel government. They have told us what the future is going to be. Some of their members have even written books about the need to cull off massive amounts of the population by any means possible. And so we see this final stage being pushed as they convince us that we are the problem. The Club of Rome, that also belongs to the same group, in the 1990s, the two founders said that back in the 1970s at the Club of Rome, they were given the task as a premier think tank for the globe, this global society, the task to find ways of reducing the population and controlling the people, to go along with this, convincing the public how to go along with it. And they said they looked at all possible means of doing so. What had worked before? Again, geopolitics, strategy. Under warfare conditions, the public will give up freedom. The public will be directed by governments, bureaucracies, and police, military, etc. Under warfare, the public sacrifice. They'll have less food, they'll ration stuff. They go along with it to save themselves. Therefore, they'd have to find a warfare strategy, a reason for war. And what they came up with was that man was the enemy of the planet. They said that the idea that global warming could be created and blamed upon mankind would fit the bill. These are the words they used. That would fit the bill, written in the 1970s and decided at the think tanks then and published by the guys involved in a book called The First Global Revolution, well worth reading. When they hit upon an idea from a premier think tank, they will never change that agenda. I've said before, it wouldn't matter if we're up to our eyes in snow all year round. They will still stick to global warming. That's the agenda. Now, of course, they've changed it slightly to climate change, which simply means changes in the weather. And they're in the process now of convincing the general public to be afraid of summer, for instance. It's all done through the alteration and distortion of perceptions. Massive psychology is used on all of this. And they certainly understand mass psychology of the general public. These boys don't simply announce things or make up a wish list of the future and send it up the chimney to Santa Claus. When they come up with an idea, they implement it. I've followed the United Nations Department of Statistics as they announce every single year the sperm count of the Western male, which has been falling drastically since the 1950s. They say that it's down by about 75-85%. Now, when something like that's happened across the whole of Europe and the Americas in 50 years, and they suddenly started noticing it 50 years ago, sudden onset, and there's no crisis made about it, there's no comeback after announcing the statistics, they just tell you the cold hard statistics and go off to the next statistic on some other topic. That means it's part of the agenda. Otherwise, it would be a crisis. If this wasn't planned and part of the agenda, believe you me, it would be a crisis if they didn't authorize it. And now they tell us that the average American has less than 20% sperm and only about 15% is motile. That's not a coincidence. What happened in the 1950s to start out this ball rolling? In the 1950s, they suddenly put all the known female synthetic estrogens into food supply. They put it in baby foods. Procter and Gamble were the first one to admit, after investigation 40 years later, that they were using a rinse to supposedly sterilize the baby bottles, and it contained bisphenol A. An odd thing to rinse baby bottles with, when bisphenol A is the very thing that attacks young male children at that age and stops the testes from developing properly. You go back even further into more detail and you find out that the cosmetic industry were using insufflatants. Insufflation is a technique where certain carriers are put into the creams themselves, and these creams then absorb into the skin carrying other chemicals with them. They're almost like they carry the payloads into the target in the bloodstream. We find that the women were highly toxic with the artificial bisphenol A and other ingredients. And therefore, within the first 8 to 12 weeks of pregnancy with a male child, there's a very good chance that male would grow up to be either almost completely sterile or, as I say, maybe have some motile sperm. This was all understood 50 years ago. Bisphenol A, for instance, was discovered in the 1890s. And the properties it had against humans, especially males, was known then too. Now it's in all the beer cans. Great target males again. They line the cans with it. There's been many exposés on it now. The CBC in Canada, which is a government-owned television station, it's the BBC, basically, of Canada, did a documentary series called the Disappearing Mail. And it goes through all of that in that particular talk with proof. Also, when we go back to the writings of Lord Bertrand Russell and Julian Huxley and Aldous Huxley, who were also related to the Darwins, by the way, you'll find that they talked about ways to sterilize the populations in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. But of course, and even said they would use the needle to create a compliance, pliable population, meaning to dumb down the people and also to bring down the fertility rates. In the 1950s, across Europe and the Americas, what came out, under vast promotion, what came out? The polio vaccine came out. That was the first one ever to come out through a mass fear campaign. A massive fear campaign. Polio was very, very rare. Yet if you go back to the old PATH, black and white newsreels, that they showed all over the world at the time, they showed you the same one boy in the iron lung, and that terrified the whole world. How many polio cases was actually there? Was it really polio? We do know that from those first shots, those injections, the generation that got them all ended up with carrying 100 simian viruses, live simian viruses in the shot, and simian 40 only had one function according to the maker, the discoverer of the vaccine, and that was to cause cancer. And I also have a copy of the discussion with this particular man and his staff admitting that. They knew that at the time. What they said was they thought that the risks outweighed the bad benefits that might come along down the road. That was their excuse. Since then, we've been trained to accept more and more inoculations until babies now get something like 30 inoculations before they're out of the hospital. When you look into the big manufacturers of inoculations, like the Baxter Laboratories that were in the news recently because they sent out live flu virus along with the bird flu virus mixed together and were caught by another country who tested it on ferrets, and the ferrets all died. They had done the very thing that they say that they're worried about happening in nature, where the common flu is mixed with a killer flu and becomes highly contagious. They actually did it by mistake, we're told. But go back into Baxter Laboratories even further, and you find Baxter Laboratories was part of IG Farbing Group in World War II. They were responsible for creating chemicals and so on that were used as gas. And they were also used in other medical experiments on prisoners. That's in the records of the inquiry that went on into IG Farben. A good book to read is The Crimes and Punishment of IG Farben. All of that stuff's documented in there. All the companies, the Western corporations that were involved in the setting up of the Hitler regime are mentioned in that book. And Baxter Laboratories, the one who's coming out with all the shots with the take supposedly for the swine flu, are still on the go. So when you go into let's see, Connaught Laboratories as an example. Connaught Laboratories was employed during World War II to manufacture bacterium and viruses, fungus that would attack wheat and corn, etc., in Germany. Mr. Banting, who discovered insulin, the great hero Banting, during World War II, his main occupation was finding ways to annihilate the food supply of an entire country. And he came up with ideas of creating a form of what we now call mad cow disease, something that rotted the brains of the cattle for herds, dairy herds and beef herds. And it was manufactured in World War II. And I often wonder if that's really, if there really is such a thing as mad cow disease, is that where it came from? But to say these big laboratories and Connaught Laboratories eventually became responsible, for instance, for the blood supply for hospitals and hemophiliacs and byproducts of blood supply for Canada. When Mr. Clinton was in power, he signed a deal with some prisons in the US where the prisoners would get a dollar or two for a pint of blood. And this stuff was all to be sold to Canada. And almost every hemophiliac in Canada, everyone who got the blood supply came down with hepatitis and various other diseases. The government held about a 10-year inquiry, waiting until they were all pretty well dead, maybe one or two survived, before they paid out compensation. They knew at the very beginning that this blood was contaminated. And these Carnot laboratories, part of the military-industrial complex used in World War II, buying the blood and selling it and distributing it across Canada. When the CBC did a documentary on Carnot laboratories and their role in this, the little guy who purchased it was caught on the steps of his office of the building, and he turned around and he said to the camera crew, after who questioned him on all the deaths that were caused in Canada, thousands of them, he said, "It's business." That was the only reply given. I've said for many years that the biggest international corporations are real corporations, but they're also front groups for one system. During the Cold War, for instance, many books were published on the war, how it would be won, and so on. And what they all agreed upon was those with the highest technologies would win. Now, if you were in a free enterprise system, you could never allow inventions coming out of nowhere, unauthorized, especially in communications and different means, to be given to the general public. Therefore, the CIA, MI6, and other countries' agencies created front organizations to lead the charge and control technology. You could never allow free competition in technology and give it to the people without authorization. It has to be permitted by those who rule. That goes across the board with everything, as I say, from those who rule. You create culture, you manipulate culture, you give the public what you deign to give them, you suppress that which you don't want the public to have. It must be under a control. You cannot have that with a true free market enterprise and true entrepreneurism. You can't have it. Therefore, you put up the front companies. They're real companies. They will really manufacture stuff, but it's what's been authorized. And guys at the top, CIA, MI6, fund them and run them. We've seen this with different banks that were set up by CIA in the past, where they funneled money to all the major wars we were fighting. It was the BCCI, was one of the first ones that collapsed. Papa Bush was a director at one time. And then he was back to being director of the CIA. These are front massive banks, massive corporations. A difficult thing for some people to understand is what's happening today is not just an elite making a final move to take over anything. Every generation for hundreds of years has been brought up with the same elite's predecessors designing and running the show for each generation. The elite, in fact, are simply moving their system into a new system, an updated system to suit themselves. That's a hard concept for people to grasp. They've been trained to believe things are happening at the moment by happenstance, by crisis coming out of nowhere, and here's what we must do. We must solve this problem at the time. Nothing is further from the truth. And when people wake up, they generally go through the same stages as someone who becomes bereaved when you find that democracy never existed in the first place. You go through an anger phase, a depression phase. You'll blame whoever is handy. And then hopefully you emerge from it and you become active. And you want to learn what's really going on and what has been going on. But you'll also eventually come to the realization that you're up against something, a system that's very, very, very old. It's the only truly organized system on the whole planet. It uses sciences that are ancient in population management. It gave us a system of money, money is a tool that we must believe in to serve them. Karl Marx was quite right. He was one of their boys who was set up to set up the dialectic. And he was quite right when he said that money is a tool of the elites. It's essential that the people who stop bartering or working for themselves and start using money as a means of exchange, which then can be taxed back from them, are becoming slaves. Because under law and legality, for a thousand years, no one could take anything from you. Money represents your food, your home, everything. When it's taxed back from you, they're creating a form of slavery. Therefore, it's essential that the workers believe in money. The elite have all the money in the world. They own all the resources in the world. They don't need money, but they need us to believe it's the only thing that we must use. Today, the power of the purse, as they call it at the top, is being used to the maximum to tax almost everything back from the people that they earn. You tie that in with Charles Galton Darwin in his book, The Next Million Years, where he lays out the next few thousand years, up to a million years, for the elite and all the changes that will happen. The grandson of Charles Darwin, who again was related to the Huxleys and many others. And he said, we are in the process, in the 1950s he said this in his own book, we are in the process of creating, he says, slavery has always existed in one form or another. There's different ways to have slavery. You can either get a bunch of henchmen, force a tribe into obeying you and being your slaves. That's a lot of force. But you have to feed them, etc. Or you can allow them to keep so much of their earnings for themselves to maintain themselves and take off all the rest to supply the elite and the structure of the system over them. But he says, we are now in the process of creating a more sophisticated form of slavery. In other words, the general public who would drift into the system and it would become natural for them would never twig on that they were actually slaves. You tie that in with the institutions that the Huxleys and the Darwins belong to. The Royal Institute for International Affairs, which has branches in every country in the world, they set up the United Nations. They said in their own writings from the earliest times to the present, the world they're bringing in is to be a world where everyone who is born or would be allowed to be born would be born to serve the state. That would be their sole function. That's if they had a job for you to fulfill or a need for you. But it's a more sophisticated form of slavery. And we're going through it today. These families have been at this for at least centuries, and I think much, much longer. Why is it that the Rothschilds come onto the scene as a revolutionary family? Why is it they suddenly could take over five countries with five sons, create central banks, or take the central banks over that already existed? And why is it that right to the present time, they're in the forefront of world politics? Why is that? Why doesn't a generation of the Rothschild go off in some other direction or lose interest? You're dealing here with a specific religion and a cause, a purpose. You will only find this kind of fanatical intergenerational devotion to an agenda when there's some kind of religion involved in it. When did all these families crop up? With the banks. We find that when the Rosicrucian court was created at Queen Elizabeth I's court, and that's open history today, John Dee, Francis Bacon, Francis Drake, all these boys were a member of the Rosicrucians. It also broke out in France and Germany at the same time, and they even announced their presence by billboards all across Paris. But the members now, as I say, in Britain, were open in the time of Queen Elizabeth I. Their idea was to gain gold and money through plunder, and they basically lived off of the Spanish galleons for an awful long time, as the Spanish were taking the gold out of South America. But John Dee and Bacon also were advisors to kings and queens. And they wrote about how to control, guide, mislead, and always fool the populations, and always, too, to get them into warfare, thinking they knew what they were fighting for, but the public were never to know the true ambitions that they had. John Dee coined the term the British Empire. It didn't exist before he said it and wrote it down. He went to the Queen with the idea, and he said, a system should be set up where countries are invaded or taken over by Britain to create a world system which would be based on free trade. Free trade. It says those countries willing to adopt the British system would be given special status and its most favoured nation trading status. The very same terms that are now used in all the charters they draw up for free trade across the planet. Yet we're going back 500 years to find it first used by an advisor to Queen Elizabeth I. So therefore we know there was a world plan underway. We also know that Kipling, for instance, who worked for the British Raj in India, wrote many books, and was a very, very high Freemason, was sent over to the US, where he spoke to the US Senate, equal to equal, and said, we pass the torch on to you. America was then to take over the financial cost of conducting this world at war, basically, to take over a world until into a global system. I'm Alan Watt, and I'm a long-term researcher into the geopolitics and the psychopolitics of a world society, basically, the society that's bringing in globalism in our lifetime. In the 1950s, a book came out called The Next Million Years, and that was done by Charles Galton Darwin. Now, the Galtons, again, were another special bunch that came out to do with eugenics. And they set up the IQ tests that are now used across the world for school children to try and get the average intellect of children, classify them in grades, etc. And they then intermarried with the Darwins. So Charles Galton Darwin was the grandson of Charles Darwin. He was a physicist. Again, too, what we're talking about is what Huxley said. Huxley being the end product of selective breeding to get a scientist, then so was Charles Galton Darwin. They were bred along the Platonic lines. Plato talked about it too. And they became the scientific class. Charles Galton Darwin was a top physicist in Britain, worked on atomic energy, weaponry and so on, but he also was attached to other delegations at the United Nations, had a lot of power, was well known, getting a lot of exposure on political viewpoints and social viewpoints in the media. And he came out with the book in the 50s called The Next Million Years. The Next Million Years is an astonishing book because it's an incredible boast of how an elite would literally rule the world for another million years, and how it would be done, not just could be done, but would be done. But his biggest cry throughout the whole book was that the media and educational systems would have to work so hard on the general public, even from schooling up, to get the public to go along and allow themselves to be somehow sterilized. He said that the inferiors would outbreed the superiors, and that was his greatest fear. Now, he spoke on behalf of his own establishment, his own group, so they're into eugenics. And you'll find the United States became a great laboratory for eugenical experiment. People don't really realize that. Because when many of the Albigensian descendants, the Cathar descendants, the Bogomel descendants came into the United States under the guise of Christianity, they set up their own particular eugenical experiments. The Mormons were one of them. where couples were matched up. One of the greatest experiments that's ever happened in history was the NIDA experiment on NIDA, New York, where the man who set it up was given free rein to match up men and women, not to live forever together, but only to copulate for specific offspring. Charles Darwin was involved in the experiment. The newsletter that the NIDAs set out went to also the Huxleys. H.G. Wells came over at the latter end for visits to it as well. It was one of the greatest eugenical experiments ever carried on, under the protection and the guise and the rights of protection of Christianity. That's how they got away with it. And the man, Noyes, who was in charge of it, was a high mason. His cousin was Hayes, who became the president of the United States. So big people were backing this experiment in eugenics through the latter part of the 1800s into the 1900s. What did they hope to gain? How can we bring this into the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Institute for International Affairs, or the writings of, say, Huxley's or Darwin's even? Well, they believe, and they believed by Darwin's time, that all of the people who had the right stuff to excel in life, to acquire wealth, good, intellect, property, and keep a hold of it through generations, had already been born. Therefore, anything that came after Darwin was just chance, perhaps, or luck. Therefore, all the elite families were already established. There would be no more elite families. Everyone else married in common because they did not have their wives or their husbands picked for them. They were not mated up for eugenical reasons. They were called commoners. We find the same expression coming out today with the new term for eugenics. They call it bioethics. And the bioethicists are saying that those people, the common people, have junk genes. It's another slander on the public, you see. Meaning, you have all these weird, erroneous genes because none of you down through the generations were specifically married up for specific reasons. Whereas you go into the line of, or the lineage of Darwin, and the Darwin family and many other families of his time were already only breeding into one other family for generations. And the Darwins, for about five generations that we know of, by records, birth records, and marriage records, only married into the Wedgwood family, the big pottery conglomerates. And when Charles Darwin's first wife died, he married his mother's sister, who was a Wedgwood as well. The problem with this incredibly close inbreeding, and I should say too, the Huxleys were also descended from Darwin too, you'll find contacts there, and their wives. How many of these families, these wealthy elite families, were actually into inbreeding in this fashion, this close inbreeding, we'll never really know. Maybe one day they will publish it. But I know that Ian Taylor came out with an excellent book on Darwin called Darwin and the New World Order, where he documented the lineages of at least the Darwin family to do with the Wedgwoods. And as I say, the unfortunate thing of such close inbreeding is you can have, if there's a dominant gene there prone to a specific illness or disease, it tends to be passed on. And I think that with genetic research, they hope to overcome the problems they've had with such close inbreeding for themselves. But genetic research will not be used for the benefit of the rest of humanity, even though it's our tax money that's going into and has been going into the research for so long. All geneticists are eugenicists because it starts off in your first course to do with eugenics. Superior and inferior types. Therefore, at the start of their training at university, they become true believers in eugenics to begin with. We've been told that the double helix and the genes and so on wasn't discovered until Watson came along around the 70s or so. and that they'd always suspected that there were things called genes. This was standard in all medical training for many, many, many years, but they hadn't found them. They just suspected they were there, were told. But yet, if you go into the writings of the greatest mathematician that the Royal Society could produce, called Rutherford, he's the guy they sent off abroad to do the equations for the pyramids and so on for the Royal Society. In his own memoirs, he said that in the early 20s, he was employed on scientific research as a mathematician to work on genes. Why would you need a mathematician working on genes for something you haven't discovered yet? You can't see them unless they could see them. And I believe that's how far ahead they truly were back then. They did know the genes were there. They were working on them heavily. Because, as I say, the agenda since at least Darwin's time onwards was to create a superior type of human. They toyed with the idea of creating even a superior type of worker to serve the superior class. Someone who could be very, very healthy, bright enough to accomplish all the tasks, but not too bright to overthrow the dominant minority. That's what their utopia or their utopic idea is basically based upon. Some of them are so arrogant, like the Julian Huxley, who was the first CEO of UNESCO, who said that UNESCO's function, by the way, the United Nations Organization for Education Worldwide, was to create a standardized system of education across the world so that all children could be manipulated into the same thought patterns, belief patterns, and mentality, basically, a standardization process, a Plato's cave that we'd all grow up in, never knowing anything outside that cave. He was quite blatant about that. It was for social engineering purposes, not for educational purposes as such. Now, eugenics goes back, as I say, into most ancient times. All kings and queens were mated up for their supposedly inherited traits as leaders and even as gods by the priesthoods, who kept records of the traits, the physical and mental personality traits of offspring of these unions. The one thing that was lacking was a moneyed class who also used the same techniques. We find this coming out with the Rothschilds family. So you had monarchies running the world, running an empire such as the British Empire. All you needed now was the moneyed system to go along with it. We find the Rothschilds worked on the same principles as monarchies. They married, they intermarried each other to keep the same intellects, abilities, and so on going. With the Rothschilds, we find they only marry their nieces, their immediate nieces, down through the generations. We find Benjamin Franklin, very interesting man long before this, again, high Freemason. This is in his own records at the Franklin Institute. He joined the English Lodge. He joined other lodges. He became eventually the Grand Master of the Nine Sisters Lodge in France. He initiated Voltaire in as a member and others. But he was also a member of the Hellfire Club in England. Benjamin Franklin talks about the carriers. He called them dollies. These are women who had selective genes. They were the products themselves of selective special breeding. And the Hellfire Club, like many Masonic, high Masonic institutions of that time, had what were loosely called, and wrongly in a sense, brothels attached to them. But it was also a cover, because the special carriers or dollies, and dollies, the term that Franklin himself coined, is still in use today. A dolly is a carrier, like something you carry luggage on or whatever. He said that those who were worthy to go on and breed with these particular women, who were of noble birth, most of them, would have the pleasure of having the offspring, knowing they had the offspring, and the offspring was guaranteed a life of high exposure in science and perhaps leadership in the world. Madame Bouvier was the one he was talking about initially at the Hellfire Club in Euston High, Wycombe, London. And Madame Bouvier's descendants still live. There's two of them in France today. And the other one was Jackie Kennedy. If you look at how politics is run, and you go into the writings of people like Lenin, for instance, Lenin said that there are 1,000 directions and systems in which people could go and live under. But the public mustn't know that. He said it's important that the system that's created for them is accepted by the people, so that they think that's it's the only system that could possibly work. And it's true. We're contained in a system of left and rights, supposedly the have-nots against the haves, or those who own the means of production against those who don't, the workers. And that's traditional Labour versus Tory, or Conservative versus Democrat. That's how the system is run. It keeps the public contained within a system of thinking that it must be one or the other, or a middle road in between, which they push. It never occurs to the general public that society has lived in the past under many different types of systems. And as Lenin said, it's important that the public don't know that the system they're born into was designed for them, and that it could be any different. They must think it's the only natural one that could have evolved in their lifetime. Therefore, you're contained within a restriction of parties. You vote in one party when you're sick of the last one, not because you want the new one in. It's because you're sick of the last one and what they've done to you. And once they've been corrupted and gone off in different tangents in ways where they never explained during the entire elections, and nothing to do with their election promises, you vote them out and get the next party in. And so we go on forever with this left-right paradigm, always thinking, it's like a tennis match, really, with the public in the middle. We're the ball, and we just seem to go back and forth between left and right, left and right, left and right. Meanwhile, we're being shepherded all along in one direction, because politics is a tool of the elites to manage the public. That's all democracy, in fact, really is, a tool of the elite to contain the public, manage them, and guide them along a predetermined path that's outside of any kind of democracy. But if you take Bush, what he was sent in to do was to wait, and I believe this truly, he was to wait for 9/11 happening in 2001. 2001 happened, every country automatically went on board with the same agenda at the same time, which shows pre-planning. Bureaucracies and different governments do not work that fast. It takes years to get that kind of cooperation, that kind of synchronicity working together and synchronization. Bush's job was to bring in a totalitarian system under the guise of protecting the public, where you lose your rights, and set up the machinery, the agencies to do it, the military forces, the paramilitary forces now that the police have become, to set up the institutions for enforcement of laws. Obama comes in, takes over the institutions that are now set up, and his job is to guide you through the economic depression and use those forces against the public at the required time. That's how it works. There's a continuity as far as I'm concerned. It's not a separate regime whatsoever. The same boys who put Bush in, the bankers and all the rest of it, put Obama in, and Obama's proved his loyalty to them by literally allowing them to rape the public of all their funds and then rewarding them by public funding and tax money to save the same bankers. He's one of their own boys. But he now has the machinery in place that Bush set up to quell the coming riots that they say are going to come, and to manage the public into a brand new system of what they call not government, but governance, international governance. If you listen to Obama's speeches before he was elected, and I analyzed what he actually said, he said very little. He was giving emotive speeches with no substance. He never said what he wanted to do or how he was going to do anything. It was almost like a lead-up to a movie that hadn't been made yet. Emotional talk, talk of hope, but not saying how the hope would be transformed into realities. He used the term that's been used in academia for the last few decades in the Ivy League schools and universities of the century of change. So his slogan became, and they used slogans written for him, change is good. Any idiot should ask the simple question, wait a minute, what change are you talking about? How can you be for change if you don't know what the change is going to be? It could be for your detriment. But they got the people parroting, like George Orwell said with the sheep, you know, four legs good, two legs bad. Change is good. And the people, his followers, start to repeat it, change is good. What kind of change are we talking about? The loss of sovereignty, the blending into an international institution, a world government system, a system where not only is America bankrupt and the most indebted nation on the planet for loaning money out to other countries and policing the world, being the policeman of the world. Now Obama wants to lead the charge on sustainability, carbon taxes, by making America the example for the rest of the world to follow. He's asking everybody to sacrifice everything they have. That's what he means by change is good. He didn't dream up this plan. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Again, that comes from the Milner Group, the Cecil Rhodes Society, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, that planned world governments using Britain based as a model for the British Empire, now become the American Empire in a sense. And the changes here he's talking about is a new world of servitude, where you will serve the world state. And you'll also have to pay off all your debts along the way, which is impossible as far as I'm concerned. You cannot ever pay the kind of debt America has incurred since World War II. It's impossible to pay back. Therefore, the changes he's talking about really is a New Deal. When you hear a New Deal mentioned by any president, and we got that from FDR, we got it from Bush, last Bush it was in, a New Deal. We're getting it from this administration. That's a legal admission from the leader of your country of a new system. A New Deal is literally a new system. The first system was the Constitution. You got an updated system with FDR as government became incredibly big and centralized. And now you've got a New Deal under the guise that change is good. Who planned the change? It wasn't the people who planned the change. Who will benefit? Well, will not be the people. It's the world of sustainability, Mr. Rockefeller, the population reduction plan. Those who will go into the future will be those who are necessary for the future's maintenance, and those who are simply obsolete, the useless eaters, will have to perish and die off. It's as simple as that. This generation today, the ones who are alive today, we are the generation that's going through the biggest changes in history, according to even Rockefeller himself, since the Industrial Revolution. It's the end of one part, one phase of a long-term plan. And out of this comes a new world order. As they've said, Mr. Brown said, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, said at the G20 meeting recently, it's a new world order, a different order from the previous one, where people technically were working for themselves, would choose their own employment and so on. The new world order is a planned system, a planned economy, a planned population. So it's up to us. It's not up to the next generation to change this. We're the only ones who can possibly do the changing. And it's either really the rights to go into an uncertain future, which is what life should really be, where we decide for ourselves where we want to go individually and collectively, or allow ourselves to be dumb animals, creatures, who are guided by those who have decided they are the masters of our destiny, and allow ourselves gradually to be sterilized, killed off, used for the last part of their agenda and their wars, and then cast off. Many people will love socialism. They enjoy being guided, and they enjoy their bosses running the world for them. But it's up to those who like freedom, personal freedom, which also entails uncertainty of where we're actually going to go.